if we actually want to change this reality, we need to become an internal actor within our society, saying that and believing and really convincing other people that this is the self-interest of both Palestinian citizens of Israel and Jewish citizens of Israel to not allow this reality to continue to happen.
We had a helicopter, took a half-inch line, I think it was, across the gorge, get the first cable across there, and then from there we progressively got larger cables.
From what we understand from reports and videos, they used the VKS pepperball guns to fire OC spray pellets, the batten round launchers to fire rubber bullets, and flashbangs that are explosive disorientation devices.
We want to be influencing governments and regulators around the world to make sure that, as I said earlier, single pilot ops does not happen. It should not happen. It must not happen.
We had been organizing a show as a showcase to promote our Fair Pay at South by Southwest campaign, which since last year has been demanding that artists get fair pay. And one of the reasons that we've always been calling for that is the shady relationships that the festival has continued to have and have only accelerated with the new corporate ownership.
You're listening to the Labor Radio Podcast, weekly produced by the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org. I'm Chris Garlock. On today's show, Randy talks with the co-chairs of Standing Together About Palestine, Israel. Tom Owens talks bridges. Victoria police use explosive weapons at the Web Dock picket. Plus, discussions on the current status of ALPA Canada, United Musicians, and Allied Workers. This week's featured shows are Union Talk, the podcast from the American Federation of Teachers, Chasing the Hook, a podcast about union ironworkers' stories told by the old-timers, Solidarity Breakfast, a rank-and-file worker and trade union show covering current affairs, progressive issues, and news and events from the Australian labor movement, ALPA Canada Podcast, a new official podcast for ALPA Canada, the segment of the Airline Pilots Association that manages all things Canadian, and Art and Labor, a podcast for art workers trying to understand their place in the brutal capitalist systems of power. Just a reminder, we now have t-shirts available with the cool Labor Radio Podcast Network logo in two colors. You can check them out, laborradionetwork.org. Here's the show.
Welcome to Union Talk. I'm Randy Weingarten.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Union Talk. This is our 49th episode, and this is a pretty special one. Not that I don't think every one of them are special, but this is with a group of Jews and Palestinians. They're all citizens of Israel, and they are part of a group called Standing Together. Standing Together is a grassroots movement in Israel proper that mobilizes Jews and Palestinians in the pursuit of peace, equality, social and climate justice.
Thank you, everyone, for coming here. I'm 32. I live in Haifa. I'm originally from Ma'alia, which is a Palestinian town near the Lebanese borders, closer to Lebanon in the north. You know, Standing Together, before we really start talking about it, we do need to acknowledge where we're coming from. We need to acknowledge our reality, and who listened to me earlier today listened to it. But it's important for us, coming as a Palestinian, you know, who is coming from an Israeli-based organization, from the Israeli society, and talking about the Israeli society as part of it, as Palestinian, is almost mission impossible at these days. So it's important for me to acknowledge that. And also, we are really witnessing one of the most catastrophic human losses and crises in decades, if not in of the century. They're trying to not only go against Palestinians in Gaza, Palestinians in the West Bank, but actually persecuting the 20% population within Israel. Arresting us, harassing us, expelling us from work and from universities. And they are really spreading tens of thousands of arms right now, who are right now in Israeli society being used against women, against Palestinians, against marginalized groups in our cities. And that's in Israeli society. And the reason why I say this is because we need to debunk the myth that Jewish safety is dependent on the oppression of Palestinians and military controlling Palestinians. We need to debunk the myth that the US, by giving so many guns and military aid unconditionally to a lunatic government, government of openly fascist ministers who have messianic fantasies of eradicating the Palestinians, the other people living on the land, and giving them complete support, a blank check policy, that's somehow supporting us as people in Israel. Being pro-Israeli and pro-Israeli government is actually against the people in Israel. And if you are for the Jewish safety, you have to be for the Palestinian freedom and the other way around. There's no way around it.
Part of the reasons we've made this difficult choice, and Randy actually had to beg and Sharon for us to agree to leave, no, to leave home again after a few months. We've been here in November after 5 months of war, is that we felt that it is very important for us to try and come here and try and tell this untold story of this amazing fact that is so unseen sometimes, that Israel has a society, that we are also a people, that we also have fears and traumas, you know, hopes, conflicts with our government, and that it is the missing component, the missing part of the puzzle in terms of understanding how do we translate this energy of so many people in the world right now, understanding that this reality must end, that the war must end, that the occupation must end, that the killing and destruction in Gaza must end. For many, most Israelis, what we are doing right now in Gaza is an act of survival. For many Israelis, what the government is promising them, destruction, elimination, you know, flattening Gaza, it is a promise of self-survival. It is a promise of the only way possible to actually make sure that this thing will not happen again. And Hamas actually says we will do it again, right? We heard these quotes of them. And with this soil, with this reality, it is very easy for the right wing, for the very crazy messianic people that are in power, in our leadership, to kind of capitalize and to try and build these terrible trends of openly calling for killing children, killing innocent people. And I think that this is what Sally means when we say that we cannot come and morally lecture people. We can shout this truth, saying that killing innocent people, destroying 70% of all the homes and houses in Gaza, that's not going to bring us safety. We can shout at them that it's just fascism or it's racism and no, this war is terrible. But if we actually want to change this reality, we need to become an internal actor within our society and to not give up on the patriotic stand of our internal place in our society, of saying that and believing and really convincing other people that this is the self-interest of both Palestinian citizens of Israel and Jewish citizens of Israel to not allow this reality to continue to happen, to end the occupation, to end this war, to achieve a ceasefire agreement, to end the killing and destruction in Gaza, and to bring back the hostages.
That was Union Talk, the podcast from the American Federation of Teachers. Next up, Chasing the Hook, a podcast about union ironworker stories told by the old timers.
What's up, brothers and sisters? Just a quick intro into this episode. I speak with Tom Owens on this one. He was a project manager, project engineer for American Bridge for 36 years. I was able to talk with Tom was that his son reached out to me on Instagram after I made a post about the New River Gorge Bridge in West Virginia that was constructed by American Bridge in the 1970s. I took an opportunity to ask Tom how that project went, Tom worked on several projects that are pretty special throughout the country. And so this is a guy that that has seen a lot of things in his lifetime. And I really enjoyed this conversation. And I really think you will, too. So you were a project manager on the new New River Gorge Bridge. What was that project like?
That was the most difficult job I ever worked on because it was a world record at the time we built the bridge. It was 3,030 feet long, and it was across this very deep gorge from the top of the roadway to the river was 876 feet. And we built a 1,700-foot arch there, and then the deck trusses on top of it. We used two 330-foot towers in a cable way, and they were spaced apart and staggered so that we could lift to the right or the left to get to the width of the bridge. And just the magnitude of getting the cableways up and getting it ready to erect was very, very difficult.
How long was the planning process before you actually got to the job?
I was assigned to the project in July of 1973. I came off of the second Chesapeake Bay Bridge out of Annapolis. I left there, went to Pittsburgh, and started working on the erection plans for the New River. And I went to the job site, I don't know, I guess it was February, March of 74. And I was there for 3 years and then into Pittsburgh to finish up the paperwork and to finalize the contract.
Wow. So, like, when you guys first started erecting, so I spoke to an iron worker, Don Vick Sr. Do you remember working with him, Owen?
I remember the name.
Okay. And he told me kind of the same thing about the difficulties of constructing that arch. Can you kind of talk about, like, how, what the process of that was and some of the difficulties that you ran into?
Well, it was a major operation just to get the cableway up and getting it functioned. It was set up that each cableway, they were 16 foot apart in both directions so that they could lift to right or left to get the width of the bridge. They were set up to pick 50 tons each, and we had a balance beam to go between them that would allow a 100-ton lift. We had one piece in the bridge that started off the arch that weighed 94 tons.
That's a lot of weight there. So did you guys use Owens, I think I read this, but correct me if I'm wrong, sirs. Did you guys obviously use a helicopter to start the cableway line across the gorge? I mean, that seems like the only logical way to get it across, but maybe I'm wrong.
We had a helicopter, took a half-inch line, I think it was, across the gorge, get the first cable across there. And then from there, we progressively got larger cables. The gut cables for the high line was 3-inch cables. And we worked progressively from the helicopter line to the 3-inch cables.
You're with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're going to now move to a chat that I had with Anthony Kelly from MELS, the Melbourne Activist Legal Service. On March the 22nd, down at Webb Dock, there was a picket against Azim Ship, one of the Palestinian, Israeli companies transport companies. And this has been, they've been targeted by Unionists for Palestine and supporters over time. There's been several pickets, but this particular one, March 22nd, marked the ramping up of police actions against activists. And they particularly involved the use of explosive weapons. And I caught up with Anthony to find out more about the explosive weapons and what happened.
Thanks very much for talking to me, Anthony, about this particular issue, which is the use of explosive weapons and KIPs by the Victorian police at a rally down at Webb's Dock. Can you explain to my listeners what you mean by these kind of weapons?
Sure. So Victoria Police have been using these weapons really since 2016 when they were provided through a big Victorian Labor Party community safety package. Billions of dollars worth of new equipment was provided to Victoria Police, partly in response to the racialised crime panic that was waging through Victoria around the time. Now, these weapons, including the batten round or rubber bullets, as they're sometimes called batten round launchers, or the pepperball guns that fire tiny round balls filled with OC spray or paint in some circumstances. They've been available to Victoria Police, but they've only been used in protest scenarios, really within the Victorian prison system, when prisoners protest or disrupt their incarceration in some form or another. So the critical incident response team generally deploy these weapons inside in those circumstances. They've also been deployed against large Airbnb sort of parties out in the western suburbs at various times. And we saw them deployed first in August 2021 during the anti-lockdown protests. But on Friday night was one of the more recent times that we've seen these deployed against protesters who were picketing Azeem ship down at the Victorian International Container Terminal at Webb Dock in Port Melbourne. So the public order response team, escalated their response to these pickets to what's sometimes called a level 4 riot response, essentially, where they had shields and the mounted unit horses were there, and they used, from what we understand, Knowles didn't have a legal observer team present on the night, but from what we understand from reports and videos, they used the VKS pepperball gun to fire OC spray pellets, the batten round launchers to fire rubber bullets, and flashbangs that are explosive disorientation devices. They're also used in many other protest scenarios around the world, but also most namely in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, ironically. So they're really loud explosive devices that create flashes and 180 decibel or so explosions that they create. They're designed to create disorientation and panic and clear an area. And also the batten rounds that fire the rubber bullets.
So if you have the police acting in this way as a reactive manner, and then they're given much more powerful, dangerous, explosive weapons, this is a real... And then it's been called a community safety package. This is quite quite a worrying aspect to law enforcement, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've been tracking the rise and the escalation of these sort of violent and repressive crowd control measures over many years, as you know. We've called for an immediate ban on the use of explosive devices such as the stinger grenades and the flashbangs, and that's mainly due to that there's a clearly documented accounts of their misuse and their danger to humans, to harm, maim or kill. And also the fact that existing accountability measures in Victoria and across Australia, including the measures under legislation, the restrictions on use of force in Victorian and in Australian legislation are not adequate, and the accountability measures within Victoria are simply not adequate to curtail or control the misuse of force by police.
Hello, welcome to the first edition of the ALPA Canada podcast. I am Tim Perry, the ALPA Canada president and WestJet pilot. I'm here with our VP of Admin and Finance, Louis-Éric Mangrain, and glad to have you on the podcast with us, Louis-Éric. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. Tim and I are in our offices in Ottawa right now recording this first podcast. It's a nice thrill. About myself, most of the listeners don't know me personally. So quick run through. I've been an airline pilot since 2007. ALPA work, I've been the LEC secretary, treasurer, and vice chair at Air Transat for one term. And I've been the Vice President Administration and Finance for ALPA Canada since January 1st, 2023. I'm sitting before you, Tim, but I've known you for about a decade. Going back to my LEC years at Air Transat, you were also an elected rep at the MEC for WestJet. But most people listening don't know you as well as I do, so how about you give them a little run-through what brings you here?
I am from Winnipeg, Manitoba. That's where I was born and raised. I got my private pilot's license there. I went to flight college in Castlegar, BC at Selkirk College, no longer in business. And 14 years ago, I joined WestJet. And I was at the front end of the organizing drive there and served as the WestJet MEC vice chair. And I've held this position as president of ALPA Canada for the last 5 years.
You obviously have seen a lot from COVID to getting out of COVID and the massive growth. Can you talk to us a little bit more about what is it that ALPA Canada does on a daily basis and what the last five years have been for you?
Sure. I think that, you know, everything that we do here at ALPA Canada falls into these two buckets. One is advancing ALPA I positions in Canada with our Canadian stakeholders and government, and the other is advancing issues of interest to the Canadian members that are specific to Canada. And so, you know, our work falls into that bucket, but it definitely is GA heavy. Our work is to engage our federal government at labor and at transport in particular.
Interesting. GA standing for Government Affairs, not General Aviation, for those of you listening. And I mean, we've discussed about engaging federally, provincially, but we also have an influence, or we engage outside of our borders internationally. Can you talk to us a little bit more about this?
ALPA Canada is a member association of IFALPA, the International Federation of Airline Pilots Associations, and we're actually a separate and distinct member association from US ALPA. So we share a union, but we have two seats at the table, and we're able to bring, as I said earlier, the Canadian perspective to those issues, and we do so in conjunction and collaboration with our brothers and sisters in the United States. That's to our advantage to approach things that way. And similarly, we are a separate affiliate of the ITF, the International Transportation Workers Federation. And both of those organizations are involved at ICAO. And if we want to influence international outcomes, we have to be active with the international organizations.
So what are the hot topics right now in ICAO? Like, what are the things that, again, I put myself in the shoes of a line pilot listening right now. How are things dealt at ICAO affecting my actual career or the future of it?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of big things going on right now around the world. First of all, you may have heard of extended minimum crew operations. And what we're talking about here is single pilot in crews flight ops. And, you know, we have a regulatory framework in Canada where that's not likely to be the first place we see this around the world. But we all know that what happens elsewhere eventually makes its way to our shores. And if we don't want to see single pilot ops in Canada, it's incumbent upon us to make sure that the regulatory framework around the world prevents that.
There's already a campaign against CMCO, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So IFALPA and the European Cockpit Association, as well as ALPA International, is involved in a campaign that Safety Starts With Two. You may have seen it, and if you haven't, you will. And we want to be influencing governments and regulators around the world to make sure that, as I said earlier, single pilot ops does not happen. It should not happen. It must not happen.
Hi, I'm OK Fox. Welcome back to Art and Labor. Art and Labor 2, as it's called now. Art and Labor 2, it's returned. We're back. And I'm joined by our brand new sound engineer slash potential co-host, if nobody else really wants to do it, Marshall. Marshall, say hello.
Hey.
Marshall, tell the people about yourself a little bit.
Well, I know how to record sound, and
oh, that's
I own
so
the equipment
true.
To do it.
He sure so. Does. And Marshall, who is an incredible organizer with the group United Musicians and Allied Workers.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about UMA.
Oh, yeah. So United Musicians and Allied Workers formed back at the beginning of lockdown. Because everyone had stopped playing shows and they were freaking out about not making money and kind of paying closer attention to the streaming money they weren't seeing. So a bunch of artists got together and we all organized and held an action. It was Worldwide Day of Action, demanding that Spotify pay us, 1 cent per stream. And they said they did not respond, actually.
Yeah.
They didn't say anything.
No.
So we spent a number of years organizing and, you know, reaching out to different artists and researching kind of what was going on with streaming. All the while doing other stuff. We organized actions at South by Southwest last year.
For the people who, have been listening. The latest thing is the CIA's involvement in South by Southwest.
Yeah, so not just
like
CIA,
the State Department and defense contractors.
The CIA did have some involvement last year.
I remember that.
And because last year we were there and kind of looking through the conferences that were being held, and there were some pretty wild ones that they were involved in. And this year, actually, the Department of Defense sponsored
the whole thing.
I don't think the whole thing, but part of the festival.
Oh, okay.
And again, it's not like we have like access to their books and can say like with certainty who spent what and who's doing what. But yeah, it seems like for the most part, they're taking a bunch of money from the Defense Department, and they had a part of the festival that, like a section, a whole venue that was specifically for panel discussions and demoing like new technology that, I think a lot of people were pretty upset about.
South by Southwest, the Defense Department, why are they involved? People are pulling out. Fuck South by. I mean, fuck. But this is what my point of bringing up the old South by fucking shit is like, fuck South by. Why do we even care? Why are we even bothering? Who gives a shit? They suck. Always sucked.
I think like for us, like the reason that we, let me backtrack a little bit. So because of all this like energy and because everybody was really upset, like a lot of the artists started to pull out, and we had been organizing a show as a showcase to promote our Fair Pay at South by Southwest campaign, which since last year has been demanding that artists get fair pay. And one of the reasons that we've always been calling for that is the shady relationships that the festival has continued to have and like have only accelerated with the new corporate ownership when Penske Media came in and bought them.
Yes. Oh, the same bitches who destroyed Artform.
Yes. One and the same. Yes. So Penske Media is now the official operator of the festival, and they
Let's fucking go.
Yeah. So they so are people are already pretty upset. We had this alternative show, and when people started dropping out, because they were upset that DOD was sponsoring part of the festival, we immediately reached out to some of the artists, and they were able to come over and play our festival. Like, it's weird that people haven't noticed how bad it's been and the relationships they've had in the past. And like, and it's another thing. I think for me, it's just another thing that's like been shocking within this past year, like with Gaza, because so many people, like, I mean, that I surround myself with, like yourself, have always been aware of certain negative relationships that we've kept, and, you know, exist within like the environments that we have to work as artists, and like to see a bunch of people be like super cognizant of it all of a sudden, I guess it's just surprising. Like, it's still it's fair. A little bit shocking to me. Like,
I get that.
Like, every time I hear people like talk about it.
Hey, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Just a small sample of the amazing programs aired over the last week on more than 200 Labor Radio and podcast shows. They're all part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, shows that focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows, laborradionetwork.org. You can also find them, use the hashtag LaborRadioPod on X, Facebook, and Instagram. This podcast is recorded under a SAG-AFTRA collective bargaining agreement. The Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, edited this week by Patrick Dixon. I produce the show, and our social media guru is Harold Phillips. For the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show. We'll see you next week.